Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today, we're going to resume with more from Hector Human Rowe, The Complete Stories of Saki, and as usual, we will do four stories. And we're more than halfway through them, but we still have about 40% of them to go, I would say. We'll pick up with the story simply titled Fate. Page 343. Fate. Rex Dillett. Dillett, D-I-L-L-O-T, was nearly 24, almost good-looking, and quite penniless. His mother was supposed to make him some sort of an allowance out of what her creditors allowed her, and Rex occasionally strayed into the ranks of those who earned fitful salaries as secretaries or companions to people who were unable to cope, unaided with their correspondence or their leisure. For a few months, he had been an assistant editor and business manager of a paper devoted to fancy mice. But the devotion had been all on one side, and the paper disappeared with a certain abruptness from club reading rooms and other haunts where it had made a gratuitous appearance. Fancy mice, my God. Still, Rex lived with some air of comfort and well-being, as one can live if one is born with a genius for that sort of thing, and a kindly providence usually arranged that his weekend invitations coincided with the dates on which his one white dinner waistcoat was in a laundry return condition of dazzling cleanliness. So he manages to do just enough to keep going and keep up appearances. He played most games badly and was shrewd enough to recognize the fact, but he had developed a marvelously accurate judgment in estimating the play and chances of other people. Good. Saki likes gambling and betting. We've heard a lot in the stories about betting on sports, so this is interesting. So maybe he's going to try to make his living as a gambler, which is always makes for an interesting story. So he played most games badly himself, but he was shrewd enough to recognize the fact. He had no illusions. And his lack of illusions about himself was merely part of a greater thing in which he could see how well good others were. So he actually has a rare talent in that regard. Most people don't realize the actual value of their opinions. He had developed a marvelously accurate judgment in estimating the play and chances of other people, whether in a golf match, billiard handicap, or a croquet tournament. By dint of parading his opinion of such and such a player's superiority with a sufficient degree of youthful assertiveness, he's provoking other people into making bets, he usually succeeded in provoking a wager at liberal odds, and he looked to his weekend winnings to carry him through the financial embarrassments of his midweek existence. Trouble was, as he confided to Clovis Sangrail, that he never had enough available or even prospective cash at his command to enable him to fix the wager at a figure really worth winning. Someday, he said, I shall come across a really safe thing, a bet that simply can't go astray, and then I shall put it up for all I'm worth, or rather for a good deal more than I'm worth, if you sold me down to the last button. Sold me up to the last button. It would be awkward if it didn't happen to come off, said Clovis, as loads and loads of locks and sure things fail. People would be destroyed by that. It would be more than awkward, said Rex. It would be a tragedy. All the same, it would be extremely amusing to bring it off. Fancy awakening in the morning with about £300 standing to one's credit. I should go and clear out my hostess's pigeon loft before breakfast out of sheer good temper. Your hostess of the moment mightn't have a pigeon loft, said Clovis. I always choose hostesses that have, said Rex. A pigeon loft is indicative of a careless, extravagant, genial disposition, such as I like to see around me. People who strew corn broadcast for a lot of feathered inanities that just sit about, cooing and giving each other the glad eye in a Louis XIV manner, Louis XIV manner, are pretty certain to do you well. So he likes people who are into extravagances and very liberal because he needs what they have to offer. Young Strinet is coming down this afternoon, said Clovis reflectively. I dare say you won't find it difficult to get him to back himself at billiards. He plays a pretty useful game, but he's not quite as good as he fancies he is. I know one member of the party who can walk around him, said Rex softly, an alert look coming into his eyes. That cadaverous-looking major who arrived last night. I've seen him play at St. Moritz. If I could get Strinet to lay odds on himself against the major, the money would be safe in my pocket. This looks like the good thing I've been watching and praying for. Don't be rash, counseled Clovis. Strinet may play up to his self-imagined form once in a blue moon. I intend to be rash, said Rex quietly, and the look in his face corroborated his words. Now he better watch that those two don't set up against him. He better be sure that Clovis is his friend. Are you all going to flock to the billiard room? Asked Teresa Thundleford after dinner with an air of some disapproval and a good deal of annoyance. I can't see what particular amusement you find in watching two men prodding little ivory balls about on a table. Oh, well, said her hostess, it's a way of passing the time, you know. A very poor way, to my mind, said Mrs. Thumbleford. Now, I was going to have shown all of you the photographs I took in Venice last summer. You showed them to us last night, said Mrs. Couvering hastily. Those were the ones I took in Florence. These are quite a different lot. Oh, well, sometime tomorrow we can look at them. You can leave them down in the drawing room, and then everyone can have a look. I should prefer to show them when you all are gathered together, as I have quite a lot of explanatory remarks to make about Venetian art and architecture, on the same lines as my remarks last night on the Florentine galleries. Also, there are some verses of mine that I should like to read you on the rebuilding of the Campanile, bell tower. But, of course, if you all prefer to watch Major Latin and Mr. Strinet knocking balls about on a table. They're both supposed to be first-rate players, said the hostess. Of course, no one wants to listen to her lectures. I've yet to learn that my verses and my art causerie are of second-rate quality, said Mrs. Thundleford with acerbity. However, as you all seem bent on watching a silly game, there's no more to be said. I shall go upstairs and finish some writing. Later on, perhaps, I will come down and join you. To one, at least, of the onlookers, the game was anything but silly. It was absorbing, exciting, exasperating, nerve-stretching. I would have groveled. And finally, it grew to be tragic. Could you tell I was doing a bunny there? That's one voice I like. It's just fine, very funny. From Trading Places. The major with the St. Moritz reputation was playing a long way below his form, and young Strinet was playing slightly above his, and had all the luck of the game as well. From the very start, the ball seemed possessed by a demon of contrariness. They trundled about complacently for one player. They would go nowhere for the other. 170, 74, sang out the youth who was marking. In a game of 250 up, it was an enormous lead to hold. Clovis watched the flush of excitement die away from Dillett's face and a hard white look take its place. He's getting scared. How much have you got on? Whispered Clovis. The other whispered the sum through dry, shaking lips. It was more than he or anyone concerned with him could pay. He had done what he said he would do. He had been rash. He'd bet money he doesn't have. That's how you get your arms broken or killed or go into bankruptcy. Plus, 206.98. So he needs a great comeback from Stinnett. Rex heard a clock strike 10 somewhere in the hall, and then another somewhere else, and another and another. A house seemed full of striking clocks. Then in the distance a stable clock chimed in. In another hour they would all be striking 11, and he'd be listening to them as a disgraced outcast, unable to pay, even in part, the wager he had challenged. So that would make him a man without honor, a bounder, a cad, but even worse. 218, 103, The game was as good as over. Rex was as good as done for. He longed desperately for the ceiling to fall in, for the house to catch on fire, for anything to happen that would put an end to that horrible rolling to and fro of red and white ivory that was jostling him nearer and nearer to his doom. 228-107. Rex opened his cigarette case. It was empty. That at least gave him a pretext to slip away from the room for the purpose of refilling it. He would spare himself the drawn-out torture of watching that hopeless game played out to the bitter end. He backed away from the circle of absorbed watchers and made his way up a short stairway to a long, silent corridor of bedrooms, each with a guest's name written in a little square on the door. In the hush that reigned in this part of the house, he could still hear the hateful click-click of the balls. If he waited for a few minutes longer, he would hear the little outbreak of clapping and buzz of congratulation that would hail Strinnett's victory. On the alert tension of his nerves, there broke another sound, the aggressive, wrath-inducing breathing of one who sleeps in heavy after-dinner slumber. The sound came from a room just at his elbow. The card on the door bore the announcement, "Mrs. Thundleford." The door was just slightly ajar. Rex pushed it open an inch or two more and looked in. The August Teresa had fallen asleep over an illustrated guide to Florentine art galleries. At her side, somewhat dangerously near the edge of the table, was a reading lamp. If fate had been decently kind to him, thought Rex bitterly, that lamp would have been knocked over by the sleeper and would have given them something to think of besides billiard matches. There are occasions when one must take one's fate in one's hands. Rex took the lamp in his. 237-115. Strinnett was at the table, and the balls lay in good position for him. He had a choice of two fairly easy shots, a choice which he was never to decide. A sudden hurricane of shrieks and a rush of stumbling feet sent everyone flocking to the door. The Dillett boy crashed into the room, carrying in his arms the vociferous and somewhat disheveled Teresa Trundleford. Her clothing was certainly not a mass of flames, as the more excitable members of the party afterwards declared, but the edges of her skirt and part of the table cover in which she had been hastily wrapped were alight in a flickering, half-hearted manner. Rex flung his struggling burden onto the billiard table, and for one breathless minute the work of beating out the sparks with rugs and cushions and playing on them with soda water siphons engrossed the energies of the entire company. "It was lucky I was passing when it happened," panted Rex. "Someone had better see to the room. I think the carpet is all right. Or I think the carpet is alight." As a matter of fact, the promptitude and energy of the rescuer had prevented any great damage from being done, either to the victim or her surroundings. The billiard table had suffered most, and had to be laid up for repairs. Perhaps it was not the best place to have chosen for the scene of salvage operations, but then, as Clovis remarked, when one is rushing about with a blazing woman in one's arms, one can't stop to think out exactly where one is going to put her. So that was a pretty typical Saki story, I guess we would say. Next story is The Bull. Tom Yorkfield had always regarded his half-brother, Lawrence, with a lazy instinct of dislike, toned down, as years went on, to a tolerant feeling of indifference. There was nothing very tangible to dislike him for. He was just a blood relation with whom Tom had no single taste or interest in common, and with whom, at the same time, he had no occasion for quarrel. Lawrence had left the farm early in life, and had lived for a few years on a small sum of money left him by his mother. He had taken up painting as a profession, and was reported to be doing fairly well at it, well enough at any rate, to keep body and soul together. He specialized in painting animals, and he was successful in finding a certain number of people to buy his pictures. Tom felt a comforting sense of assured superiority in contrasting his position with that of his half-brother. Lawrence was an artist chap, just that and nothing more, though you might make it sound more important by calling him an animal painter. Tom was a farmer, not in a very big way, it was true, but the Helsery farm had been in the family for some generations, and it had a good reputation for the stock raised on it. Tom had done his best, with the little capital at his command, to maintain and improve the standard of his small herd of cattle, and in Clover Ferry He had bred a bull, which was something rather better than any of his immediate neighbors could show. It would not have made a sensation in the judgment ring at an important cattle show, but it was as vigorous, shapely, and healthy a young animal as any small practical farmer could wish to possess. At the King's Head on market days, Clover Fairy was very highly spoken of, and Yorkfield used to declare that he would not part with him for 100 pounds. 100 pounds is a lot of money in the small farming line, and probably anything over 80 would have tempted him. It was with some especial pleasure that Tom took advantage of one of Lawrence's rare visits to the farm to lead him down to the enclosure where Clover Fairy kept solitary state, the grass widower of a grazing harem. Tom felt some of his old dislike for his half-brother reviving. The artist was becoming more languid in his manner, more unsuitably turned out in attire, and he seemed to incline to impart a slightly patronizing air, a slightly patronizing tone to his conversation. He took no heed of a nourishing potato crop, but waxed enthusiastic over a clump of yellow flowering weed that stood in a corner of, by a gateway, which was rather galling to the owner of a really well-weeded farm. Again, when he might have been duly complimentary about a group of fat, black-faced lambs that simply cried aloud for admiration, he became eloquent over the foliage tints of an oak copse, on the hill opposite a copse, a group of trees. But now he was being taken to inspect the crowning pride and glory of Helsery. However grudging he might be in his praises, however backward and niggardly with his congratulations, he would have to see and acknowledge the many excellencies of that redoubtable animal. Some weeks ago, while on a business journey to Taunton, Tom had been invited by his half-brother to visit a studio in that town where Lawrence was exhibiting one of his pictures, a large canvas representing a bull standing knee-deep in some marshy ground. It had been good of its kind, no doubt, and Lawrence had seemed inordinately pleased with it. "The best thing I've done yet," he had said over and over again, and Tom had generously agreed that it was fairly lifelike. Now the man of pigments was going to be shown a real picture, a living model of strength and comeliness, a thing to feast the eyes on, a picture that exhibited new pose and action with every shifting minute, instead of being glued into one unvarying attitude between four walls of a frame. Tom unfastened a stout wooden door and led the way into a straw-bedded yard. "Is he quiet?" asked the artist as a young bull with curly red coat came inquiringly towards them. "He's playful at times," said Tom, leaving his half-brother to wonder whether the bull's ideas of play were of the catch-as-catch-can order. Lawrence made one or two perfunctory comments on the animal's appearance and asked a question or so as to his age and such like details. Then he coolly turned the talk into another channel. "Do you remember the picture I showed you at Taunton?" he asked. "Yes," grunted Tom, "a white-faced bull standing in some slush. Don't admire those Herefords much myself. Bulky-looking brutes don't seem to have much life in them. Dare say they're easier to paint that way. Now this young beggar is on the move all the time, aren't you, Fairy?" "I sold that picture," said Lawrence, with considerable complacency in his voice. "Have you?" said Tom. "Glad to hear it, I'm sure. Hope you're pleased with what you got for it." "I got 300 pounds for it," said Lawrence. Tom turned towards him with a slowly rising rush of anger in his face. 300 pounds. Under the most favorable market conditions that he could imagine, his prize, Clover Fairy, would fetch hardly 100. And here was a piece of varnished canvas painted by his half-brother selling for 3 times that sum. It was a cruel insult that went home with all the more force because it emphasized the triumph of the patronizing, self-satisfied Lawrence. The young farmer had meant to put his relative just a little out of conceit. So there's an example of a very good phrase you can find and use yourself if you're a writer. Out of conceit. Put him a little out of conceit. You see what's going on here, and you'll remember it. Even if you forget the specifics, you'll forget this. You'll remember this idea of putting someone out of conceit. Who else would say that? You don't see that kind of writing nowadays. So he's in the typical one-upsmanship, suburban way, English way, Anglo way, money way. he's going to show, or you could say human way if you want to be less uncharitable towards the Anglos. You could say, yeah, he's going to show him, hey, I'm doing a little better than you. That stupid thing I painted. Oh, yeah, that's worth, you said your cow might be worth 100. Well, mine is worth and has sold for 300. Chew on that, bro. The young farmer had meant to put his relative just a little out of conceit with himself by displaying the jewel of his possessions, and now the tables were turned, and his valued beast was made to look cheap and insignificant beside the price paid for a mere picture. It was so monstrously unjust. The painting would never be anything more than a dexterous piece of counterfeit life, while Clover Fairy was the real thing, a monarch in his little world, a personality in the countryside. After he was dead, even, he would still be something of a personality. His descendants would graze in those valley meadows and hillside pastures. They would fill stall and byre and milking shed. Their good red coats would speckle the landscape and crowd the marketplace. Men would note a promising heifer or well-proportioned steer and say, ah, that one comes of good old Clover Fairy stock. All that time, the picture would be hanging, lifeless and unchanging, beneath its dust and varnish, a chattel that ceased to mean anything if you chose to turn it with its back to the wall. These thoughts chased themselves angrily through Tom Yorkfield's mind, but he could not put them into words. When he gave tongue to his feelings, he put matters bluntly and harshly. Some soft-witted fools may like to throw away 300 pounds on a bit of paintwork. Can't say as I envy them their taste. I'd rather have the real thing than a picture of it. So he's defensive, and that proves he's wrong. And remember, Saki is not indifferent here. He himself is an artist. And so he's making the case for art, or he's showing how most people look at art. He nodded towards a young bull that was alternately staring at them with nose held high and lowering its horns with a half-playful, half-impatient shake of the head. Lawrence laughed, a laugh of irritating, indulgent amusement. I don't think the purchaser of my bit of paintwork, as you call it, need worry about having thrown his money away. As I get to be better known and recognized, my pictures will go up in value. That particular one will probably fetch 400 in a sale room 5 or 6 years hence. Pictures aren't a bad investment if you know enough to pick the right work of the right men. Now, you can't say your precious bull is going to get more valuable the longer you keep him. He'll have his little day, and then if you go on keeping him, he'll come down at last to a few shillings worth of hoofs and hide, just at a time, perhaps, when my bull is being bought up for a big sum for some important picture gallery. It was too much. The united force of truth and slander and insult put over heavy a strain on Tom Yorkfield's powers of restraint. Put over heavy a strain on Tom Yorkfield's power. In his right hand, he held a useful oak cudgel. With his left, he made a grab at the loose collar of Lawrence's canary-colored silk shirt. So he's wearing a bright yellow silk shirt. And you can guess how that combines with mud. Lawrence was not a fighting man. The fear of physical violence threw him off his balance as completely as overmastering indignation had thrown Tom off his, and thus it came to pass that Clover Fairy was regaled with the unprecedented sight of a human being scudding and squawking across the enclosure, like the hen that would persist in trying to establish a nesting place in the manger. In another crowded happy moment, the bull was trying to jerk Lawrence over his left shoulder to prod him in the ribs, while still in the air, and to kneel on him when he reached the ground. It was only the vigorous intervention of Tom that induced him to relinquish the last item of his program. Tom devotedly and ungrudgingly nursed his half-brother to a complete recovery from his injuries, which consisted of nothing more serious than a dislocated shoulder, a broken rib or two, and a little nervous prostration. After all, there was no further occasion for rancor in the young farmer's mind. Lawrence's bull might sell for 300 or for 600 and be admired by thousands in some big picture gallery, but it would never toss a man over one shoulder and catch him a jab in the ribs before he had fallen on the other side. That was Clover Fairy's noteworthy achievement, which could never be taken away from him. Lawrence continues to be popular as an animal artist, but his subjects are always kittens or fawns or lambkins, never bulls. So that's a good and funny story by Saki. Next one up is Moral Vera. M-O-R-L-V-E-R-A. One word. Moral Vera. I have no idea what that means. Is it a name? Is it a place? Is it a thing? What is it? The Olympic Toy Emporium occupied a conspicuous frontage in an important West End street. It was happily named Toy Emporium because one would never have dreamed of according it the familiar and yet pulse-quickening name of Toy Shop. There was an air of cold splendor and elaborate failure about the wares that were set out in its ample windows. They were the sort of toys that a tired shop assistant displays and explains at Christmas time to exclamatory parents and bored, silent children. The animal toys looked more like natural history models than the comfortable, sympathetic companions that one would wish, at a certain age, to take to bed with one and to smuggle into the bathroom. The mechanical toys incessantly did things that no one could want a toy to do more than a half a dozen times in its lifetime. It was a merciful reflection that, in any right-minded nursery, the lifetime would certainly be short. Prominent among the elegantly dressed dolls that filled an entire section of the window frontage was a large, hobble-skirted lady in a confection of peach-colored velvet, elaborately set off with leopard-skin accessories, if one may use such a conveniently comprehensive word in describing an intricate feminine toilet. She lacked nothing that is to be found in a carefully detailed fashion plate. In fact, she might be said to have had something more than the average fashion plate female possesses. In place of a vacant, expressionless stare, she had character in her face. It must be admitted that it was bad character. Cold, hostile, inquisitorial, with a sinister lowering of one eyebrow and a merciless hardness about the corners of the mouth. One might have imagined histories about her by the hour, histories in which unworthy ambition, the desire for money, and an entire absence of all decent feeling would play a conspicuous part. So she's an evil doll. As a matter of fact, she was not without her judges and biographers, even in the shop window stage of her career. Emmeline, age 10, and Bert, age 7, had halted on the way from their obscure backstreet to the minnow-stocked waters of St. James's Park and were critically examining the hobble-skirted doll and dissecting her character in no very tolerant spirit. There's probably a latent enmity between the necessarily underclad and the unnecessarily overdressed, but a little kindness and good fellowship on the part of the latter will often change the sentiment to admiring devotion. If the lady in peach-colored velvet and leopard skin had worn a pleasant expression, in addition to her other elaborate furnishings, Emmeline, at least, might have respected and even loved her. As it was, she gave her a horrible reputation based chiefly on a second-hand knowledge of gilded depravity derived from the conversation of those who were skilled in the art of novelette reading. Bert filled in a few damaging details from his own limited imagination. "She's a bad lot, that one is," declared Emmeline after a long, unfriendly stare. "Her husband hates her." "He knocks her about," said Bart with enthusiasm. "No, he don't, because he's dead. She poisoned him, slow and gradual, so that nobody didn't know. Now she wants to marry a lord with heaps and apes of money. He's got a wife already, but she's going to poison her, too." "She's a bad lot," said Bert with growing hostility. "Her mother hates her, and she's afraid of her, too, because she's got a sarcastic tongue. She's always talking sarcasm, she is. She's greedy, too. If there's a fish going, she eats her own share and her little girl's as well, though it's a little girl is delicate." I mean, sickly. "She had a little boy once," said Bert, "but she pushed him into the water when wasn't nobody looking." "No, she didn't," said Emmeline. "She sent him away to be kept by poor people, so her husband wouldn't know where he was. They ill treat him something cruel." "What's her name?" asked Bert, thinking that it was time that so interesting a personality should be labeled. "Her name," said Emmeline, thinking hard. "Her name's Mulvera." It was as near as she could get to the name of an adventuress who figured prominently in a cinema drama. There was silence for a moment when the possibilities of the name were turned over in the children's minds. "Those clothes she's got ain't paid for, never won't be," said Emmeline. "She thinks she'll get the rich lord to pay for him, but he won't." He's given her jewels, hundreds of pounds worth. He won't pay for the clothes, said Bert with conviction. Evidently, there was some limit to the weak good nature of wealthy lords. At that moment, a motor carriage with liveried servants drew up at the emporium entrance. A large lady with a penetrating and rather hurried manner of talking stepped out, followed slowly and sulkily by a small boy who had a very black scowl on his face and a very white sailor suit over the rest of him. The lady was continuing an argument which had probably commenced in Portman Square.
"Now, Victor, you are to come in and buy a nice doll for your cousin Bertha. She gave you a beautiful box of soldiers on your birthday, and you must give her a present on hers."
"Bertha is a fat little fool," said Victor in a voice that was as loud as his mother's and had more assurance in it.
"Victor, you are not to say such things. Bertha is not a fool, and she is not in the least fat. You are to come in and choose a doll for her."
The couple passed into the shop, out of view of the hearing of the two Backstreet children. "My, he is in wicked temper," exclaimed Emmeline, but both she and Bert were inclined to side with him against the absent Bertha, who was doubtless as fat and foolish as he had described her to be. "I want to see some dolls," said the mother of Victor to the nearest assistant. "It's for a little girl of 11. "A fat little girl of 11, added Victor by way of supplementary information.
"Victor, if you say such rude things about your cousin, you shall go to bed the moment we get home without having any tea."
"This is one of the newest things we have in dolls," said the assistant, removing a hobble-skirted figure in peach-colored velvet from the window. "Leopard skin toque and stole, the latest fashion." "Toque is a hat. You won't get anything newer than that anywhere. It's an exclusive design."
"Look," whispered Emmeline outside, "they've been and took Movera."
There was a mingling of excitement and a certain sense of bereavement in her mind. She would have liked to gaze at that embodiment of overdressed depravity for just a little longer.
"I expect she's going away in a carriage to marry the rich lord," hazarded Bert.
"She's up to no good," said Emmeline vaguely. Inside the shop, the purchase of the doll had been decided on. "It's a beautiful doll, and Bertha will be delighted with it," asserted the mother of Victor loudly.
"Oh, very well," said Victor sulkily. "You needn't have it stuck into a box and wait an hour while it's being done up into a parcel. I'll take it as it is. We can go round to Manchester Square and give it to Bertha and get the thing done with. That will save me the trouble of writing. For dear Bertha, with Victor's love, on a bit of paper."
"Very well," said his mother. "We can go to Manchester Square on our way home. You must wish her many happy returns of tomorrow and give her the doll."
"I won't let the little beast kiss me," stipulated Victor.
His mother said nothing. Victor had not been half as troublesome as she had anticipated. When he chose, he could be really dreadfully naughty. Emmeline and Bert were just moving away from the window when Morvera made her exit from the shop, very carefully held in Victor's arms. A look of sinister triumph seemed to glow in her hard, inquisitorial face. As for Victor, a certain scornful serenity had replaced the earlier scowls. He had evidently accepted defeat with a contemptuous good grace. The tall lady gave a direction to the footman and settled herself in the carriage. The little figure in the white sailor suit clambered in beside her, still carefully holding the elegantly garbed doll. The car had to be backed a few yards in the process of turning. Very stealthily, very gently, very mercilessly, Victor sent Morvera flying over his shoulder so that she fell into the road just behind the retrogressing wheel. With a soft, pleasant-sounding scrunch, the car went over the prostrate form. Then it moved forward again with another scrunch. The carriage moved off and left Bert and Emmeline gazing in scared delight at a sorry mess of petrol-smeared velvet, sawdust, and leopard skin, which was all that remained of the hateful Morvera. They gave a shrill cheer and then raced away shuddering from the scene of so much rapidly enacted tragedy. Later in that afternoon, when they were engaged in the pursuit of minnows by the waterside in St. James Park, Emmeline said in a solemn undertone to Bert,
"I've been thinking. Do you know who he was? He was their little boy what she'd sent away to live with poor folks. I come back and done that."
That's the end of that story. Pretty good one. All right, the last story we'll do today will be called Shock Tactics.
Shock tactics, as you'd expect. On a late spring afternoon, Ella McCarthy sat on a green-painted chair in Kensington Gardens, staring listlessly at an uninteresting stretch of park landscape that blossomed suddenly into tropical radiance as all expected figure appeared in the middle distance. Odd word choices there. I'm not sure if someone was messed up. "Hello, Bertie," she exclaimed sedately when the figure arrived at the painted chair that was the nearest neighbor to her own and dropped into it eagerly, yet with a certain due regard for the set of its trousers. "Hasn't it been a perfect spring afternoon?" The statement was a distinct untruth as far as Ella's own feelings were concerned. Until the arrival of Bertie, the afternoon had been anything but perfect. Bertie made a suitable reply, in which a questioning note seemed to hover. "Thank you ever so much for those lovely handkerchiefs," said Ella, answering the unspoken question. "They were just what I've been wanting. There's only one thing spoilt my pleasure in your gift," she added with a pout. "What was that?" asked Bertie anxiously, fearful that perhaps he had chosen a size of handkerchief that was not within the correct feminine limit. "I should have liked to have written and thanked you for them as soon as I got them," said Ella, and Bertie's sky clouded at once. "You know what mother is," he protested. "She opens all my letters, and if she found I'd been giving presents to anyone, there'd have been something to talk about for the next fortnight." "Surely at the age of 20, began Ella. "I'm not 20 till September," interrupted Bertie. "At the age of 19 years and 8 months," persisted Ella, "you might be allowed to keep your correspondence private to yourself." "I ought to be, but things aren't always what they ought to be. Mother opens every letter that comes into the house, whoever it's for. My sisters and I have made rows about it time and again, but she goes on doing it." "I'd find some way to stop her if I were in your place," said Ella valiantly, and Bertie felt that the glamour of his anxiously deliberated presence had faded away in the disagreeable restriction that hedged round its acknowledgement. "Is anything the matter?" asked Bertie's friend Clovis when they met that evening at the swimming bath. "Why do you ask?" said Bertie. "When you wear a look of tragic gloom in a swimming bath," said Clovis, "it's especially noticeable from the fact that you're wearing very little else. Didn't she like the handkerchiefs?" Bertie explained the situation. "It's rather galling, you know," he added, "when a girl has a lot of things she wants to write you and can't send a letter except by some roundabout underhand way." "One never realizes one's blessings while one enjoys them," said Clovis. "Now I have to spend a considerable amount of ingenuity inventing excuses for not having written to people." "It's not a joking matter," said Bertie resentfully. "You wouldn't find it funny if your mother opened all your letters." "The funny thing to me is that you should let her do it." "I can't stop it. I've argued about it." "You haven't used the right kind of argument, I expect. Now, if every time one of your letters was opened, you lay on your back on the dining room table during dinner and had a fit, aroused the entire family in the middle of the night to hear you recite one of Blake's poems of innocence, you would get a far more respectful hearing for future protests. People yield more consideration to a mutilated mealtime or a broken night's rest than ever they would to a broken heart." "Oh, dry up," said Bertie crossly, inconsistently splashing Clovis from head to foot as he plunged into the water. It was a day or two after the conversation in the swimming bath that a letter addressed to Bertie Heasant, H-E-A-S-A-N-T, slid into the letterbox of his home and thence into the hands of his mother. Mrs. Heasant was one of those empty-minded individuals to whom other people's affairs are perpetually interesting. The more private they are intended to be, the more acute is the interest they arouse. She would have opened this particular letter in any case. The fact that it was marked private and diffused a delicate but penetrating aroma merely caused her to open it with a headlong haste rather than matter-of-course deliberation. The harvest of sensation that rewarded her was beyond all expectation. "Bertie, carissimo," it began. "I wonder if you will have the nerve to do it. It will take some nerve, too. Don't forget the jewels. They are a detail, but details interest me. Your mother must not know, yours as ever, Clotilda. Your mother must not know of my existence. If questioned, swear you never heard of me." For years, Mrs. Heasant had searched Bertie's correspondence diligently for traces of possible dissipation or youthful entanglements, and at last the suspicions that had stimulated her inquisitorial zeal were justified by this one splendid haul. that anyone wearing the exact name Clotilda should write to Bertie under the incriminating announcement, as ever, was sufficiently electrifying without the astounding allusion to the jewels. Mrs. Hesent could recall novels and dramas wherein jewels played an exciting and commanding role, and here, under her very roof, before her very eyes, as it were, her own son was carrying on an intrigue in which jewels were merely an intriguing detail. Bertie was not due home for another hour, but his sisters were available for the immediate unburdening of a scandal-laden mind. "Bertie is in the toils of an adventuress!" she screamed. "Her name is Clotilda," she added, if she thought they had better know the worst at once. There are occasions when more harm than good is done by shielding young girls from a knowledge of the more deplorable realities of life. Bertie is in the toils of an adventuress. By the time Bertie arrived, his mother had discussed every possible and improbable conjecture as to his guilty secret. The girls limited themselves to the opinion that their brother had been weak rather than wicked. "Who is Clotilda?" was the question that confronted Bertie almost before he had got into the hall. His denial of any knowledge of such a person was met with an outburst of bitter laughter. "How well you have learned your lesson," exclaimed Mrs. Hesent. But satire gave way to furious indignation when she realized that Bertie did not intend to throw any further light upon her discovery. "You shan't have any dinner until you've confessed everything," she stormed. Bertie's reply took the form of hastily collecting material for an impromptu banquet from the larder and locking himself into his bedroom. His mother made frequent visits to the locked door and shouted a succession of interrogations with the persistence of one who thinks that if you ask a question enough, often enough, an answer will eventually result. Bertie did nothing to encourage the supposition. An hour had passed in fruitless, one-sided palaver when another letter addressed to Bertie and Mark Private made its appearance in the letterbox. Mrs. Hesent pounced on it with the enthusiasm of a cat that has missed its mouse and to whom a second has been unexpectedly vouchsafed. If she hoped for further disclosures, assuredly she was not disappointed. "So you have really done it," the letter abruptly commenced. "Poor Dagmar. Now she is done for. I almost pity her. You did it very well, you wicked boy. The servants all think it was suicide, and there will be no fuss. Better not touch the jewels till after the inquest. Clotilda." Anything that Mrs. Hesent had previously done in the way of outcry was easily surpassed as she raced upstairs and beat frantically at her son's door. "Miserable boy, what have you done to Dagmar?" "It's Dagmar now, is it?" he snapped. "It will be Geraldine next." "That it should come to this, after all my efforts to keep you at home of an evening," sobbed Mrs. Hesent. "It's no use you trying to hide things from me. Clotilda's letter betrays everything."
"Does it betray who she is?"
asked Bernie. "I've heard so much about her. I should like to know something about her home life. Seriously, if you go on like this, I shall fetch a doctor. I've often enough been preached at about nothing, but I've never had an imaginary harem dragged into the discussion." "Are these letters imaginary?" screamed Mrs. Hesent. "What about the jewels and Dagmar and the theory of suicide?" No solution of these problems was forthcoming through the bedroom door, but the last post of the evening produced another letter for Bertie, and its contents brought Mrs. Hesent that enlightenment which had already dawned on her son. "Dear Bertie," it ran, the third letter, "I hope I haven't distracted your brain with the spoof letters I've been sending in the name of a fictitious Clotilda. You told me the other day that the servants, or somebody at your home, tampered with your letter, so I thought I would give anyone that opened them something exciting to read. The shock might do them good. Yours, Clovis Sangrail." Yet another woman getting chastened and corrected by the men. Constant theme of Saki's. There's more, though. That's not quite the end of it. Mrs. Hesent knew Clovis slightly and was rather afraid of him. It was not difficult to read between the lines of his successful hoax. In a chastened mood, she rapped once more at Bernie's door. "A letter from Mr. Sangrail. It's all been a stupid hoax. He wrote those other letters. Why, where are you going?" Bertie had opened the door. He had on his hat and overcoat. "I'm going for a doctor to come and see if anything's the matter with you." Of course it was all a hoax. But no person in his right mind could have believed all that rubbish about murder and suicide and jewels. You've been making enough noise to bring down the house for the last hour or two. But what was I to think of those letters? Whimpered Mrs. Hesent. I should have known what to think of them, said Bertie. If you choose to excite yourself over other people's correspondence, it's your own fault. Anyhow, I'm going for a doctor. It was Bertie's great opportunity, and he knew it. His mother was conscious of the fact that she would look rather ridiculous if the story got about. She was willing to pay hush money. I'll never open your letters again, she promised. And Clovis has no more devoted slave than Bertie Hesent. What a marvelous story. What a marvelous story. They're all really good, though. I think you would have to say almost all of his stories are really good. That was Shock Tactics. Excellent. So thanks for being with me today. I'm an Alex Linder reading to you from Hector Human Row, The Complete Stories of Saki. And we've done many, 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 many sets of four of these. And they're all at vnnforum.com. And we will proceed until we finish the book and do all of them. So great stuff. Thanks for being with me. I'll be with you again for more from Saki real soon.